As day broke on the night of the Long Knives, the human monster called Razormouth was last seen escaping into the wilderness with an infant child in his arms. Not to eat, not to torture, but to protect. He wasn't always this post-human abomination. Razormouth at one point was just a troubled young man who was unfortunate enough to become the best friend to a sadistic predator named John Sunday, who is much better known these days as the Machinist. But back then, he was just an aspiring serial sadist. And as a thesis project of sorts, John Sunday took his oldest and dearest friend and dismantled him surgically, stripping away bits and pieces and remolding him into a nightmarish beast designed to kill. Fingers tapered into claws as the skin and nail from the ends had been degloved and the exposed bone tips sharpened and calcified. Tongue forked, teeth removed, lower jaw extended out to a ghoulish degree as to better accommodate the custom-built set of razor blade dentures the Machinist had forged for his monster. His sex organs had been removed, as had most of his ability to think and reason as a human. Inside and out, he had been broken down to the rawest elements, and then rebuilt as a devilish mascot for the cult called the One True Faith. Razormouth was the devil's pet hound, an enforcer and a living weapon for its leader, the Machinist, to use. After his capture, Razormouth ended up in Grace, Michigan on the night of the Long Knives. Amidst the ferocious carnage that transpired that night, one very strange and powerful moment occurred. Razormouth found himself looking into the eyes of an infant baby boy, and he chose not to kill the baby, which may not seem very significant, but to the monster, it was transcendent. This was the moment Razormouth bucked his training and had not instinctively slaughtered. He'd made a choice. All of this is in the past. The tale of Razormouth has been well documented on this show. But no matter how many unspeakable atrocities he has committed or were committed upon him, Razormouth's path of horror had only just begun and would continue to take him deeper under and closer to hell. The next step in his ascent downward was the mass murder that has come to be called the Massacre at Black Site 1. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem, killers, cannibals, and cults, fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales, and terrible truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. The town of Grace, Michigan was being swarmed with law enforcement. and rescue vehicles and federal agents. The National Guard was setting up a perimeter. At this point, it was all still pure chaos. Collecting survivors and stacking the dead, and trying to figure out what the fuck had actually happened here. And then the forest fire started in the northern end of the valley, and it was so severe that everyone still alive had to be evacuated. With all that background noise, the monster and the baby found it easy to creep away unnoticed through the woods. It took DRO spotters about 12 hours to find his trail and another 6 for the drones to get eyes on him. And to put this into some sort of context for you, this was a very long period of time for the Department of Restricted Operations. They, of course, had drones and spotters set up in the area already. The fact that Razormouth evaded being seen for so long was a testament to his instincts and his stealth. But finally, they found him. They weren't interested in killing him, though, or with bringing him in. They realized that they had an utterly unique situation on their hands, and they would be able to study the monster in its natural environment, running free and completely unbound. And cherry on top of all that, somehow, inexplicably, contrary to all documentation, everything that was known about Razormouth, he seemed to be caring for a small child. Research and development made the call to start watching him. And if at any point Razormouth posed a threat to the program, he could be cut down with sniper fire at a moment's notice. If he posed any threat to the program, to the experiment, to the DRO, not if he posed a threat to innocent human lives, which he most certainly did, but which were by and large irrelevant to the Department of Restricted Operations. This was an unprecedented learning opportunity. And using a combination of aerial drones and a 3-woman sniper team, equipped with long-range, high-def cameras mounted on their rifles, they began to film the monster in his element. And it was, to say the least, fascinating. The monster and his cub, these wildlings, were always on the move, traveling mostly at night, always in silence and in shadow. Their needs were simple: water, meat, shelter, heat, in that order. The baby was surprisingly strong, and his motor skills developed at an impossibly fast rate, because they had to. The monster was doting, ever present, never letting the cub out of his sight, no matter what was happening. After the first few days, the first few killings, the cub was no longer bothered by the gruesome violence before it. Animal or human, it didn't matter. Razormouth didn't see any difference, and therefore neither did the cub. There were 3 snipers watching at all times, filming everything they could possibly film. And they stayed in near constant contact with their team leader, a DRO special agent named Enright. None of these 3 women kept it secret that they very much wanted to get the call, the go-ahead to put down this monster. And maybe somebody could try and salvage some kind of life for this kid. But the word never came, and so they never shot. Doesn't matter what the situation is, you don't become a DRO sniper without knowing how to follow orders. So they watched and they filmed, and weeks passed. Can you imagine? Weeks. The monster and cub were not just surviving in the wild, they were thriving. It was a crude, primitive life, but in its own way, it was honest. And they were happy after a fashion. There seemed to be no long-term plans in place. Not only that, there didn't seem to be any short-term plans in place outside of immediate needs. Water, meat, shelter, heat, keep moving. Razormouth quickly learned to use the baby as a tool, and in return, the baby learned how to be useful. Primitive, but a deeply bonded relationship. When they would find a remote cabin that was occupied, after the sun set, Razormouth would put the baby on the doorstep and then slip away. When he was ready, he would make his clicking sound with his forked tongue at the baby, and right on cue, the baby would start crying. Whoever was inside the cabin would come out. This was a huge distraction that would be focused on the baby, allowing Razormouth to crawl in through a window and slaughter everyone in the house. And then he would bring the baby inside to eat and to play and eventually to sleep. Oh, that poor baby. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that, but I mean, think about it. This baby really didn't know any different, right? It was loved. The baby was being cared for, maybe not in the way society would like, but the guardian was what you and I would consider a monster. But to the baby, Razormouth was not a monster. He was the whole world. There's no doubt in my mind the sights and sounds that baby soaked up in those months will rot its brain from the inside out over the years to come. The horrors that Razormouth routinely committed in the interest of sustenance quickly became normal to the wee one. And when mass murder and cannibalism become your baseline normal, then you've got some real fucking problems in your future. Over time, things started to change. It was still a game of survival, yes, and they still live day by day, but this was the first time in ever that Razormouth didn't have a master. There was no one holding his leash. There was no one minding the cage door. He was free. And with this newfound freedom, there came something else. All wounds heal, even the ones up here. And Razormouth, he's walking scar tissue inside and out. But after a few weeks traveling the edge of civilization with his cub, even he was starting to heal. To the snipers, it looked like, they couldn't believe it, but it looked like the monster was starting to edge back a little closer towards being human. And then one day, he went too far and he fell over the edge. Razormouth let someone go. He might have been primitive, but Razormouth was nothing if not clever. And so he must have known that if he let this little girl go, that she was going to come back with others and they would be looking for the monster. Razormouth had become increasingly selective in the targets he chose over the last few weeks. He'd been avoiding places that had other cubs, but this time, he didn't smell her. This time, after slaying a mother and her lover as they slept, he found a little girl child, and she was staring up at him, her eyes wide open, like he was some kind of god. It was the exact same way that the cub looked at him. And so Razormouth let the girl walk away. And that was the moment that he started to threaten the experiment. The snipers asked for the shot, but once again were met with disappointment. There would be no orders to shoot. The containment team was being sent in. The experiment wasn't over, not by a long shot. It was just moving into the next phase. This was not the first time that the DRO had captured Razormouth. Some of the men and women on this very containment team had been there 2 years previous, and they found it much easier to take him this time around. When the team hit the room, coming in through every door and window of the cabin at the same time, the monster didn't fly into a violent rage as he did before, as they expected, but he fell back to defend the baby. They shocked him into unconsciousness and bound him in the special gloves, shackles, and helmet that had been designed to accommodate his deformities. The baby was put into a pet carrier. He clawed at the wire mesh, hissing and clicking his tongue and reaching for the monster. They were loaded into an armored transport vehicle that had been disguised as a commercial semi-truck. They were kept separated, monster and cub, but within eyesight of one another, if only to keep them calm for the long trip. They were on their way to a new home. Officially, the DRO called it research and development. But off the record, it was Black Site 1. From the apprehension point in northern Michigan to Black Site 1, which was somewhere in the southern part of Nevada, it was a 24-hour straight shot. The sniper squad watching Razormouth had been dismissed and replaced by a single agent. Special Agent Emright was well regarded as a security expert and had been the supervising agent who hired and trained the snipers for the previous job. She was much better known as Lefty. And while very few people knew her personally, everyone in the DRO knew her rep. She was kind of a legend. Ex-military, ex-black ops, ex-red ops, ex-deep red ops. Now, the enforcer and right hand for a major player in the DRO. That Lefty was watching Razormouth personally carried a lot of weight. It meant this cargo was precious. The previous phase of study might be complete, but there was still so much left to learn from the monster. John Sunday was as close to Dr. Frankenstein as the world had ever seen. What he had done with human flesh was revolutionary. What he had done with the human mind was equally impressive. And the DRO wanted to learn everything that they could about the post-human abomination Razormouth. So Lefty was trailing the convoy and watching it closely every step of the way. Monster and baby were secured and caged, given water, otherwise left alone. For the entire ride, they both pressed up against the inside of their cages, unable to touch, but still trying. 24 hours straight. Then the pavement turned into dirt and sand, and the truck circled deeper and deeper into the desolate Nevada desert. There were silent checkpoints, there were fences, there were perimeter shooters, and there were armed guards at the bunker itself, the tiny bunker that was the only access point for the completely subterranean facility. The greeting committee was 12 deep, all of them heavily armed, but still trembling inside their body armor. Lefty supervised the transfer from her car, with her gun sitting on her lap. She watched as the monster's cage was moved inside, into this place, this prison that didn't exist. The greeting committee team just moved the whole cage in its entirety. Even with him in the helmet, the gloves, and the shackles, rendering him virtually harmless, no one wanted to handle Razormouth unless it was absolutely goddamn necessary. They took the baby in through a separate entrance. The monster and the baby both hissed and clicked at each other as they parted ways.
"Please surrender all weapons and communications devices to a security officer."
Lefty signed the transfer paperwork with the facility director, which gave Dr. Ivy Williams custody and full control over the monster. As they parted ways, Lefty didn't leave. She went deeper into the facility. There was still one item left on her to-do list. She went two levels down to a corridor lined with deluxe hospital suites made up into apartments. Lefty had a gift and a message for one of the guests here. Very much unlike the prisoners and the test subjects kept at Black Site 1, the guests were afforded every luxury available, every courtesy. But very much like the prisoners and the test subjects, they were not allowed to leave.
Level 3, guest housing.
Former federal marshal Cindy Jenkins was no different. Although being as grotesquely pregnant as she was, she probably couldn't have left even if they let her. Lefty rapped on the outside of her door out of simple jailhouse courtesy and then let herself in. Jenkins was in a wheelchair, smoking an unfiltered cigarette. "My name, Special Agent Enright. But you can call me..." Before she could finish the sentence, Jenkins said, "Lefty?" Jenkins had spent her time down here reading DRO case files, and there was one file in particular relating to the father of her unborn child that she had read time and time again. A report that had been written by Lefty. Lefty said, "My boss wanted me to bring this to you as a way of saying thanks for your continued service." Jenkins waved her in and pointed towards an empty chair. The room was rank with stale cigarette smoke. So much like it still clung to the walls, it hung in the air, it made all the lights look dull yellow. Lefty sat down her gift, a sleeve of cans of Copenhagen. "I heard that you liked the tobacco," she said. And sheepishly, Jenkins explained, "Well, it's not for me. It's for the baby. You see, She feeds off the carcinogens. It's fucked up, I know. She gets it from her dad, but I keep smoking, and look how big she's getting. Jenkins was about 5 months pregnant at this point, but she looked well past 9. This here is snuff, Lefty explained. It's dip. It has 20 times the carcinogens of that cigarette. Jenkins cocked her eyebrow. Really? To your baby's health, Marshall. With that, Lefty took a seat. Not because she wanted to sit down in this place, but she wanted to be face level with Jenkins. It was a sign of respect. Do you know about me? Lefty asked. I know what's on paper. That means they let you have access to the files. Lefty was prodding her. Total access, Jenkins said. Does that make you wonder? And Jenkins said, no, not really. Them being so open, giving me total access, it could only mean one thing. It means they know I'll never have a chance to tell anyone what I read. If this old girl here doesn't kill me, she patted her belly, then they will. So there's nothing to wonder about. Lefty nodded. Jenkins had a rep for being smart. Okay, Agent Lefty, why are you here? And Lefty said, overlapping interests. I think that's the best way to put it. Personally speaking, I think them keeping you trapped as an incubator for that, no offense, but whatever the fuck it is that you got growing inside of you right now, it's not something I agree with. My boss, he doesn't care about any of that. But he would sort of like to see this whole godforsaken place burned to the ground. That's my take on it anyway. This isn't something that he's in a position to do. Not directly. Jenkins said, so you're here to help me burn this place to the ground? No. I'm just here to give you that gift. That's all. Lefty got up to leave and paused. Marshall, do you know what chaos magic is? Jenkins had to chuckle. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I do. My boss said you would. This gift here, this visit from me, this new inmate that just checked in, these aren't random events. It's all chaos magic. Jenkins picked up the sleeve of snuff cans, started to tear it open. Lefty asked her, Did you get a peek at the new star attraction yet? Jenkins shook her head. Lefty said, it's fucking weird. His eyes are pretty. And with that, the DRO agent left and shut the door behind her. The marshal cracked open that sleeve of Copenhagen and found not only several cans of dip, but a small phone. There was one number programmed into it. And when she saw the name attached, she couldn't help but smile. Officially, Black Site 1 was called Research and Development Facility 24. Or It would have been if there was any official documentation about the place. Somehow, there was not. Somehow, a high-tech facility with 7 levels of prison cells, containment tanks, surgical suites, and medical laboratories had been built, staffed, and funded without a paper trail. Such were the ways of the Department of Restricted Operations.
You have entered into a classified area. By order of the Department of Restricted Operations, please leave the area at once.
Razormouth, the incoming celebrity, had been met by a full complement. All of the guards, agents, researchers, and staff who could slip away from their posts for a few minutes all came to catch a glimpse of the monster. They gathered in a long hallway outside the elevator on the medical wing of Level 5. When the doors opened, the crowd stared at the caged beast in awed silence. Razormouth stared back at them, looking at each one of their faces, almost as if he was evaluating them. Who had guns, who wore white coats, who looked slow, who looked soft. As they studied the monster studied them. Which was, of course, ridiculous. He was a mindless beast and nothing more. Dr. Williams, the site director, dispersed the crowd with a narrowing of her eyes. In silence, she led the guards dragging the cage down to the lab at the end of the hall, where it was secured to the floor of a surgical suite. There was a stainless steel table in the middle of the room, draped in soft white blankets. Under the table, a gleaming stainless steel drain. Dr. Williams slipped into scrubs and pulled a mask over her face. She dismissed the guards and then stood in front of the cage, watching the monster. "Sit," she said. Razormouth attacked the bars of the cage, smashing against them, trying to reach for her with bound hands and a neutered mouth. Under her mask, the doctor smirked. She'd been watching the monster obsessively over the last few weeks, and her hands were itching with the excitement of dismantling this abomination, one piece at a time. 2 masked doctors entered the room, carrying the cub. The baby was thrashing and howling, but when he sensed the monster, he immediately started to calm down. Razormouth clicked his forked tongue, and the baby clicked in return, and then instantly fell quiet. The monster slammed his helmet against the bars of his cage again and again. The wire mesh gloves rendered his claws useless, but he still scraped them back and forth, trying to pry them off, trying to weaponize himself once more. The 2 doctors laid the baby on the operating table and held it still. Dr. Williams picked up a scalpel and dramatically pressed it against the pale, exposed belly of the cub. But she did not push down. She did not cut. Instead, she looked at Razormouth. "Can you understand me? Do you remember me? I will gut this boy and make you watch him bleed to death unless you obey. And with that in mind, sit. She pressed the blade until blood welled up and the cub started to wail. Razormouth retreated to the back of his cage, and then he sat.
Security breaches can result in instant termination. Please keep your credentials visible at all times.
Dr. Williams spent hours every day with the monster. She'd been preparing for the end of this particular experiment for some time now, and had pages of notes on all the different tests that she wanted to run. At first, it was a battery of psychological tests, and then the same tests with electrodes attached directly to Razormouth's brain through tiny holes that she drilled into his warped skull. After 3 days, she moved the baby into the next room. There was a full wall of shatterproof glass between them, and another doctor who had a scalpel near the cub at all times. Razormouth could still see everything, and this kept him compliant. They quickly moved beyond psychological tests and into the part that Dr. Williams was most excited about. The physical tests, the scans, the samples of every kind, all taken slowly and without any medication of any kind. The monster never gave her any reason to think that he felt pain. Not that it would have mattered. The monster made humble. The monster brought low. He did not want to stay, but he had no place to go. 3 weeks go by. And at this point, it had been almost 2 weeks since Razormouth had seen the cub in the flesh. After moving it to the next room, they'd moved it out of his sight, and now he only got to see the cub on a constant live stream that played on a TV set up near his cage. Razormouth could still see at all times that he had something to lose. His cage was outfitted with vents so they could gas him whenever they wanted, and they did. Whenever they need him moved, they usually gassed him first. But the baby was a much better insurance policy. It kept the monster docile while they slowly, gruesomely examined his unique physiology as they poked, prodded, cut, and sampled. As they moved his cage from room to room, from lab to lab, always bringing in new doctors to study him, and everyone oohed and aahed at the monster. They might have all been wearing surgical masks, but Razormouth always looked into their eyes, as if he was committing them to memory. The day finally came when Dr. Williams did not come to see Razormouth. She was reaching the end of her notes and moving on to other projects. His cage was put back on the elevator and taken deeper into the earth, to the lowest level, where the DRO kept the things that would never again see the light of day. The monsters, the mutants, the ghastly little secrets of deep red ops.
Level 7, isolation and quarantine.
Here, there was only darkness. There was no more torture, but there was also no more live feed. And the monster was finally, utterly, totally alone. And then, a new face outside of his cell. It was different from the others. She'd not come to him before. Razormouth sniffed the air. She smelled different, too. she was pregnant. Not just that, she was preposterously pregnant, as if there was an entire litter growing inside her bloated belly. At this point, Cindy Jenkins was confined to the wheelchair, quite incapable of standing on her own. "You don't remember me," Jenkins said to him, "but I remember you. These people here, they all think you're a monster, but not me. I know who you are, Michael." Hearing his name, his old name, his birth name, spoken aloud, seemed to cut him to his core. "They sent your baby away, Michael. They didn't hurt it. They didn't kill it. Do you understand? I don't know if you understand me. But they sent your baby far away from here, where you could never find him again. I'm sorry." Up close, Jenkins saw that the monster did have pretty eyes. It was weird. And she didn't know better. They looked a little misty, as if the bright blue pools shimmering had unshed tears in them. "I'm trapped here, same as you, Michael. Do you see this here?" She rubbed her belly. She pulled up her shirt so that the monster could see the shape moving under her skin. "This is my baby, Michael. They say that she's a monster too, but I don't think so. I think she's my baby, and I want to save her. Do you understand? Jesus Christ, I hope this is landing, Michael. I really do, because I need you. I have a way to get us out of here, Michael, but I can't do it alone. I need your help." Cindy Jenkins put her hand against the thick wire mesh of the cage. "Please, help me." After a moment, the monster put his hand against the cage, sealing the deal. Partners. The architect of the massacre at Black Site 1 and the executioner. Thank you for listening to another episode of A Scary Home Companion. Find the show on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or you can contact me directly through ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show or leave a review through iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, CastBox, PodChaser, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or right here at Buzzsprout. Lefty's first appearance on this show was in an episode called The Thing in the Basement, which you really need to listen to for several different reasons. Trust me. Cindy Jenkins made her debut in Night of the Long Knives, which set the stage for this story. Razormouth was also in Night of the Long Knives, as well as The Machinist, Part 1 and 2. I'd like to say, with all candor, that next week's episode is going to hit a lot harder if you've listened to all of those episodes. Bonus points if you've listened to the Priest with the Red Hands trilogy as well, because another key piece of the puzzle was buried in the middle of that. So there's your homework. Set to it. Come back soon, because part two is going to blow your mind. The episode was edited and produced by Jeff Davidson, featuring a special appearance by Eric Taylor. Music by Lobo Loco with Dream Softly, Baby. Secret Birds with Black Teeth. Kai Engel with A Note Is My Gift. Plastic Crime Wave Sound with Dead Island Boogie and Chelsea Oxendine with the theme music. There are links to all of these great bands in the show notes. Come back soon for the conclusion of the massacre at Black Site 1.